Subcommittee Human Services, this is April 23rd, it's a little late, 8:40, and we're going to hear about Senate Bill 5526, this is still a public hearing on the Oregon Health Authority, and I think we're going to go through the policy packages this morning, is that correct?
Right, Mr. Chair, members of the Subcommittee, today is day two and the last day of going through some of the investments in the OHA governor's budget.
So, Lynn, are you going to lead the charge here this morning?
I have some very capable people who are going to lead the charge.
Okay. Please come up and introduce yourself for the record, and we'll get started. I always get a kick out of the fact that we can fill up a room and other rooms on gun control, marijuana, immunizations, but when we talk about spending billions of dollars of taxpayers' money, the room is empty.
I know.
There's a message there, but I'm not sure what it is. Okay, so please get started.
Good morning, Chair Bates and members of the committee. My name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division. And so I'll start off with talking about our policy option package to address the aid and assist issue. The first slide that you're looking at is something that you're familiar with as in regards to the Oregon State Hospital presentation last week. Greg Roberts used this slide to illustrate the issue, and if something isn't done, where things would head. And so that's the problem we're trying to address, is the growing trend in individuals being referred to the state hospital for aid and assist treatment and restoration services. So our policy option package is to move more of those restorations into the community. Several bienniums ago, a bill was passed, House Bill 3100, that enabled individuals with who have been determined unable to aid and assist to be referred to the community if their services and supports were there to safely restore them. The court had that option to do that. This policy option package would provide the funding to enable communities to provide that restoration and to say yes to the courts. One of the issues that we, in looking at the aid and assist admissions to the state hospital and referrals, we have identified four counties that are the highest referrers of patients to the state hospital. Those four counties include Lane, Multnomah, Marion, and Washington counties. They account for approximately 57% of the admissions to the state hospital for aid and assist restoration. So the idea is that we would target the funding to address those particular communities so that we could get the biggest bang for our buck, so to speak, as opposed to trying to spread it out across all the counties, and you would end up diluting the funding and the services. So we are going to take a more targeted approach with the four counties that we have identified. So the funding is intended to provide certain services into the community. Some of those services are covered by Medicaid, and so the medical services that they would need would be covered by Medicaid if they're Medicaid eligible. However, there are some services that are not covered by Medicaid. For example, the restoration services. That is the service where they are educated and trained in understanding the court system and being able to participate actively in their defense. So that's one aspect. The other part of it is monitoring and supervision. Some of the services, for example, case management, would be covered under Medicaid. However, some of the degree of supervision and monitoring to enable individuals to be maintained safely in the community would require services that not necessarily meet medical necessity. So we need to provide that level of funding to provide that monitoring supervision. The other key aspect of it is housing. In Marion County, for example, I'm working more closely with them around the aid and assist population. They said that one thing that they are missing in the and the service array for those individuals is housing, where to put individuals and the funding to support an individual in the housing in the community while they provide the restoration services. The other are just unfunded mental health services that may, again, may be required by a court, but maybe not meet medical necessity, or individuals who are not eligible for Medicaid. For example, someone who is Medicare only, these services probably would not be reimbursed by Medicare, so we would need to provide funding for that.
Okay, stop there for a minute. I thought there was a question down here. I wanted to have a chance to finish first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So 57%, is that fairly proportional with what the population is compared to Oregon for those four counties?
Chair Bates and Representative Kenny Geyer, in some of those counties, it's close to their population. However, at least I'd have to double check my figures, but some of those are outside of their percentage of the population, Marion County being one of those. Mm-hmm. And if you talk to the individuals in Marion County, they'll talk about the state institutions here that are located here and that having an impact on the individuals that end up residing in Marion County and needing services.
Okay, and one follow-up, Mr. Chair, thank you. How much is it per person? I'm trying to figure out the $4.1 million. How does that compare to keeping 250 people out of the state hospital and what that would cost?
Okay. Chair Bates and Representative Kenny Geyer, when I did the math in that regards, it's about, because individuals, when they're referred, we estimated that they would be in those services for 2 months, for example, and that would work out to be about $181 a day versus $800-something dollars a day at the state hospital. So,
thank you.
I like that math.
Okay, and one of the aspects...
Just to give you a quick number on it, if you think of them as rolling through, $63 million.
Wow.
So I'm going to stop you there for a second. I got a couple quick questions. And I mean, that's a very quick number, so I don't want to be quoted there, but it's in that range. I've been contacted by Justice about this, and I don't think they share our views. I'll just say that. I don't think they want to talk to me about how to keep them out of there, so I'll be talking to them also. I'm on the other committee that puts them in there. Okay, so we'll have that conversation. The other issue you might want to look at here, another opportunity, I should say, you might want to have here. E-courts now are up pretty well across the state, and you could potentially have one person or two people, whenever one of these aid cases came up in a court, you could have an e-court situation where your individual would be sitting in Portland and talking to that court. And it's live. I mean, it's amazing. Huge screens, like watching a football game, and you're right there on the right, standing behind the quarterback. So you can really get into this stuff with e-courts in most places, so you don't have to necessarily focus just on these four counties. You might have another person who takes the other counties also. So just consider that in your thinking. That might help out also.
Yeah. Chair Bates, we actually recently we've had a few counties contact us, either through the public defender or the courts, that have individuals that they would like to divert to the community, but they were needing services, so we stepped in and worked with the community to step in and provide those services, and when needed, we provide funding. So we're looking at that happening more, especially with House Bill 2420, which is our bill regarding aid and assist, which requires a court, before they send somebody to the state hospital on aid and assist, to contact the community mental health program to look for opportunities for diversion.
I think it's a really great way to look at this and go forward with it. We're gonna have a map pretty soon, a very rudimentary, just getting started map of what's available in the community. So we can't expect miracles from that, but we get some information. And this is what we commonly call the back door to our mental health community, coming out of a hospital or diverting away from a hospital. But it's a big problem in housing, and what we have out there in the community is not strong yet. But this would be the first place I think we should put our effort in, because these patients are so incredibly expensive. Right. And I would hope that you really push this program pretty hard. The savings are huge. Thank you.
Okay. I think that covers the points I wanted to address in my presentation. Thanks.
Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, my name is Justin Hopkins. I'm the Quality Management Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here to present information on the Mental Health Certification Policy Option Package. We're looking to invest $860,000 to provide the necessary staff resources to centralize the outpatient mental health certification functions with the Oregon Health Authority. This function is necessary to preserve the health and safety and maintain some clinical quality throughout Oregon's outpatient mental health and addiction services. This is a function certification that has traditionally been performed by community mental health programs, and the regulatory process goes pretty far back in time, and it stems from a time when community mental health programs were responsible for not only receiving all of the funding for behavioral health services, but also setting up the provider networks within their communities. And our funding and contracting model has changed substantially since that regulatory process was developed. Oregon State Medicaid plan also requires that our publicly funded mental health programs that employ people who are not licensed be certified by the Addictions and Mental Health Division or by the Oregon Health Authority. They employ what are commonly referred to as qualified mental health professionals, qualified mental health associates, certified alcohol and drug counselors, and peers to deliver behavioral health services. And they are a vital part of our behavioral health continuum of care. An added benefit of centralizing this process with the state is that it will reduce administrative burden and duplicative review processes for provider organizations. So under today's structure, if you are an outpatient behavioral health provider and you operate a program in more than one county, you are subject to multiple certification reviews. So, for example, we have one program that operates in five different counties, and they go through five unique reviews that are somewhat similar, but there are inconsistencies in those reviews, and it's the same staff that are having to prepare for those reviews. So we do expect to see a reduction in administrative burden for the provider organizations, as well as for the community mental health programs. We've been working diligently to standardize the certification.
Excuse me, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee, I am very pleased to have been working with the agency on this issue a little bit in the past few months, because there are some providers, there are some CCOs that have been talking about how to streamline, how to maintain appropriate safeguards for the well-being of Oregon citizens while doing things a little better and more efficiently. And I really appreciate the agency's support in helping us talk through some of this. And there's probably at least a couple of bills that will relate to this activity. So I'm looking at this one with great interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your work. I know it's really been a difficulty for a lot of the nonprofits especially. And sometimes they've had difficulty with getting people qualified who actually were qualified to give help, especially peer groups. And if this can resolve some, that's great. Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
I was just going to echo that, because on Representative Nathanson's bill, someone from Albertina Kerr came in with a packet this big of certification. This is what they have to go with everyone.
Really?
So.
I know I've had a lot of complaints on, so thank you for your work. And thank you for what you're proposing here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to what they said, and in addition, just to clarify, if you get this funding and have the standardized certification process in place, when do you think you're going to clear the backlog of these 200 programs that haven't been certified yet?
Co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, Senator Steiner Hayward, I'd have to look at the numbers to see how many have been extended. But we do currently have some community mental health programs that are continuing these regulatory functions basically as a courtesy. while we're trying to develop this centralized process. So I'd be happy to get back to you with a number of programs that are currently extended, if that would help, and then a timeline for when we'd be able to actually get out and review them.
Yeah, quick, thank you. Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I guess the other question is, we know that we have a huge unmet need in mental health services in this state, and we also know that there are places where unlicensed mental health providers can be very helpful as adjuncts, just like medical assistants and practical nurses are in medical practices, and provide important support. I'm really interested to understand a little bit more about this. Maybe we need to have a separate conversation, but I'd like to understand a little bit more about how these unlicensed providers are being distributed along with licensed supervision, and what we could do to bring more people like that into the state or train more people up quickly to meet these unmet needs, because we have a lot of those. And Senator Bates and I were just having a conversation about this last night, about the unmet need for behavioral health services in a lot of our rural counties, rural communities. So maybe we should have another conversation about this offline, but I think it needs to be explored a little bit further, and whether we could use these folks in more robust ways. Thank you.
Thank you. So, again, we expect that this process could be in place by the end of 2015. However, we would need the staff resources in order to actually deploy the process. Some of the unintended consequences that would happen is that vulnerable populations may be at risk if we can't provide the adequate oversight of the service providers. Oregon may not be able to maintain compliance with our state Medicaid plan as it's currently approved, and the traditional community-based behavioral health organizations may not continue to be certified to provide the services. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions, and thanks for the opportunity to provide information on this.
Thank you. Any other comments? Let's talk about marijuana.
Joy.
I spent the whole morning on it, by the way, already. City Council Medford. Not on it.
I always get the fun topics.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Behavioral Health Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to talk about Policy Option Package Number 501. And to summarize our proposed plan to implement youth and young adult behavioral health prevention and evidence-based treatment in light of funding from the legalization of retail marijuana in Oregon. Measure 91 directs funds to the Oregon Health Authority for the establishment, operation, and maintenance of alcohol and drug abuse prevention, early intervention, and treatment services. This policy option package provides us with the opportunity to put needed focus on youth and young adult services, and to build community capacity to implement effective strategies and evidence-based practices. I'd like to say that we can do a better job with our youth in Oregon as far as treatment and prevention, and this does provide us with an opportunity to do so. Funds will be used to support centers of excellence and technical assistance in prevention and treatment tailored to adolescents and young adults. Funds would also be used to support local providers so that they have the tools and resources to implement effective strategies. This policy option package requests 2 full-time equivalent prevention and youth treatment staff positions to carry out an implementation strategy that is currently in development and incorporates these efforts. I don't think I've been signaling you, but you can see where we have proposed to put the funds. We don't have solid locked-in plans with these universities, but I have had conversations with Portland State University and the Addiction Technology Transfer Center about this. Marijuana use among youth has been an issue.
We have a question here.
Yes.
I imagine we may have questions on the other side, too.
And maybe this isn't the right time to ask, but you talked about, if you go back to the previous slide, you talked about $2.3 million in projected revenue for the 15-17. I've been having some conversations with the big co-chairs, as we like to call them, about what those revenues are really going to look like.
Yes.
We're a little dubious that we're actually going to have this money, this biennium, to really use. And so I'm a little curious about why you think we're going to have it and what calculations you guys are using that are the same or different. That may be more technical than we want to get into, but I want to be sure we're not promising money that doesn't actually materialize or that takes it away from something else we've also promised it to.
Yes, co-chairs Bates, Nathanson, and Senator Steiner Hayward. The figures that I was provided were from our budget forecasting team. So I did some rough figuring of my own, just using the national survey on drug use and health, looking at how many people in marijuana are likely to use marijuana, also how many people in Oregon would likely grow it, buy seeds, buy the actual product, how many would maybe transfer to the medical marijuana program. So we've also been in really close collaboration with Washington and the state of Colorado, who've implemented this, and Colorado had a much higher projected revenue from this than they actually are seeing. So I'm with you. I think we definitely need to look at this as time goes by to see what's going to come in.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Just a quick comment also comparing Colorado. I know they worked hard to devote some resources before these revenues actually came in, before the law went into effect. And I know that I at least put that idea forward before the marijuana joint committee that I was hoping would end up in this place, that we would start doing some kind of, you know, risk management education, because once you hear that it's legal, youth may get the idea that it's, oh, if that it's legal, that means it's safe. And so we didn't want to wait till the revenues came in.
That's a good
start. I'm hoping that comes to this committee.
We'll see what we see. I would echo what you've heard. Don't count your chickens before they're hatched here. And I'm thinking that one, number one, I'm glad you're thinking about it, planning and thinking ahead what's going to happen probably. But I think this is something we'll probably take up in February when we have some idea what's really happening out there. But I'm glad you're looking at this, presenting it to us, what your thinking is on it. And so when we come back in February, we might actually take action. I don't think we're going to do much with this right now because we just don't know. Mm-hmm. But I applaud your efforts to be thinking about it and laying out a plan for where we might be going.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that.
So, co-chairs and the committee, I do appreciate that. And we have spent time and staff resources actually looking at this, working with our other states, developing a strategy to basically do exactly what you were talking about, Representative Kenny Geyer, in a media awareness campaign. We're working really closely with public health. We have several meetings set up with them right now to talk about all of this and get started without any new funds. So I will just close by saying that there are reasons to focus on this, whether or not a lot of the money comes in that we think might or not. We do a survey every year. We do a survey, the student wellness survey, one year, and then in the off year, the public health division does a survey called the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey. Our survey includes sixth graders. The Oregon Healthy Teen Survey does not. And you can see as children age throughout their school years, they see marijuana as less harmful, less dangerous. They also are more likely to get their hands on it. They find it easy to get as they get older. There's some other parental attitudes that change as well over time as it relates to marijuana.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You mentioned that you've been having close conversations with your colleagues from Washington, Colorado, which is great. Do you have a sense from them, and maybe they haven't had time to do this, whether they had similar percentages of their kids thinking it was easy or sort of easy to get prior to legalization and after legalization? I mean, my hope would be that one of the things we're going to see is that once it's legal over 21 and not legal under 21, that we're going to actually see a decrease, especially since I think we're taxing it at a reasonable rate. And one of the reasons I think Colorado's had problems is they taxed it too high, which drove people back into the black market. So do you have any sense about changes in attitudes among teenagers there?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner-Hayward. Yes, in Washington, their survey has shown that the percentage of students who see marijuana as harmful has gone down, according to their survey, since legalization.
What about the easy to get part, though?
So I can get you that information.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Olson.
So I know where we're at
and nationally for tobacco use aid in the eighth grade level? Where are we at nationally in the eighth grade level for marijuana?
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, we are higher than the national rate in terms of our 30-day use and our past year use of marijuana. I can get you the exact figures, though, but I know we're higher than the national rate.
Really?
You follow up that question myself. Do you want to follow up on it?
Well, two things. One, I think the educational piece that you're addressing and what you're interested in, I think, needs to be done. The committee doesn't know here that we moved out of judiciary this earlier this week, House Bill 2313. And it's kind of a gut and stuff, but what it does, and juvenile directors came to us and asked us to do this. It mirrors that of what we do right now with minor in possession by consumption for alcohol, but we're playing it toward marijuana. And honestly, I do think that that's going to have some impact.
I'll follow up real quick on this. This information is probably self-reporting, and it may or may not be accurate. I'm hoping it is. I'm hoping it's inaccurate, if I tell you the truth, but it probably is accurate. I'm particularly concerned with the early use of marijuana across these age groups. These are developing brains yet, and we don't know the effect, but we have some information suggesting that the use of marijuana in a developing brain can have long-term lasting effect. Mm-hmm. Frankly, alcohol has less of an effect long-term. Although become alcoholic, it's a different story, of course. Give me more information about this 30-day use rate. Does that mean once in 30 days, every day in 30 days, every other day in 30 days? And it looks like it's 18.7% of 11th graders are smoking marijuana.
Co-chairs and Senator Bates, it's any use within 30 days. So it's not daily use, but
these doesn't count the kids who have dropped out of school. We have a 40% dropout rate. That's really kind of concerning that our youth are doing this. Well, the programs you're going to try to put together are going to hopefully help us out here, but it's going to be pretty tough. Please continue with the good news.
Okay.
I'm
sorry.
Mr. Chair, since I'm a member of the Joint Committee, a couple weeks back we had two ladies from Colorado had been tracking this and doing an extreme amount of research on this come before us, and it was a fascinating conversation. But they had done so much research that they had concluded that if you're smoking marijuana at this level, to the point of like 11th grade, what Karen's suggesting right now, the potential of dropping your IQ anywhere from 8 to 10 points exists.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. I understand it's permanent.
Yeah, but it is.
It's a developing brain, and it mm-hmm. continues till age 25, not 21. Did you have, I don't want to take us away too far, but it's good flow of information. Did you get any information on the committee about programs Colorado or Washington is doing trying to keep young people away from this?
They are. Both of them recognize that there is, a need for that. So,
are they having any success, do you know?
No, I don't know that.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you. So I worked with those two women. They're from Sparrow Strategies, and so they were brought in by the governor of Colorado to develop a communications strategy. And I believe they have pretty good statistics that show that they were able to change perceptions of the risk of marijuana through the kind of variety of different programs that they did to get the word out. But
thank you.
Be happy to bring them back in at some point.
I would love to see that before the session's over, and I'll be ready to, if possible, work with public health to really put a program together to try to get to people under the age of 25. Medically, I'm just really concerned. I think that, as what Representative Olson said, I've heard also permanent loss of IQ from smoking before the age of 25. I think it's been documented several times. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Again. I'll promise my last comment, Mr. Chair. I think they said that it would cost roughly $4 million for us, and then before the bill goes into effect, for us to do the kind of strategy they did in Colorado. know, maybe we don't have that money and we want to pare it back, but just to give you a sense of what they thought was needed.
Starting before the bill goes in effect and in a continuing program, has that been estimated?
I don't know what this revenue would bring in.
I'm not so interested in revenue as the program. Can you bring us that information?
Sure.
And talk to Karen about it and public health?
So I think their point was that you need to do something before revenue starts coming in. Once revenue comes in, it can be devoted to the prevention strategy.
We may want to get this off the ground.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So if you can bring that back to us, it would be really helpful. Karen, would you work with Representative Kenny Geyer on
that? Absolutely. I'm happy to get in touch with anybody that you suggest as well from Colorado.
And I have to admit that the figures you just showed me on the use by young adults is swaying me in a little different direction. We may not have the time to wait.
Okay. So just the last slide is on the treatment. We do collect data about people who enter or enroll in addiction treatment. And for youth, by and large, the primary drug of choice is marijuana, as you see. This slide represents 5 quarters worth of data starting in quarter four of 2013. And this is from the Medicaid data. So we routinely see this as the primary drug of choice for youth. So just in wrapping up, I would say that Oregon really must have a strong prevention, treatment, and recovery services strategy in addition to public health, regulatory, and enforcement efforts that are now being implemented. These efforts together are needed to counteract the negative individual, family, and societal consequences of marijuana use among youth and problem use among adults, especially young adults. This policy option package is one step toward building a solid foundation for such a strategy. And as I mentioned, we are developing an implementation plan that will be a written document that will guide us, and we're working collaboratively with public health and OLCC and other partners on that. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. We're going to switch now. Oh, next panel, come on down.
Senator Bates, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Coulomb, Budget Director of the Oregon Health Authority. I did want to provide just a very brief clarification in regard to the point that you made regarding the revenues for the marijuana distribution to the Addictions Mental Health Program. We probably skipped through the slide too quickly, but for slide 5, it sort of predicates that after accounting for its obligations in receipt of the tax revenue, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission then distributes to AMH the amounts. So the $2.3 million that you saw on the slide is really just sort of like an expenditure limitation level, and much to Senator Steiner Hayward's comments, very well on point that we can't spend what we don't get. And so, of course, as we proceed, we'll be focusing on doing the whole collection of the implementation and facilitation of services, and then we'll only be proceeding with those contractual obligations and arrangements that we make for the Center of Excellence with youth and such as the revenues materialize. So we'll need to make sure, as you so eloquently put, Co-Chair Bates, cash in hand so we don't count our chickens before they hatch.
Unless we decide that we need a program preemptively.
Correct.
And that may be the case. Representative Kenny Geyer, you'll get information for us on it, please. Thank you. I like to dump jobs to other people. It's a pretty bad habit, but
I'm sending it to you right now.
Okay.
So good morning. My name is Leslie Clement, and I'm the Chief of Policy and Analytics. And today I'm going to just talk to you about the policy option packages that include 402-2 and 402-3. Both of these seek funding through a 50-50 state and federal match rate for a 9-month period of time to sustain critical resources previously funded through the state innovation model grant that ends in September 2016. And while today the SIM grant funds 44 positions. We are seeking approval to continue 21 of those positions, the equivalent of 7.98 FTE, funding for contractual services, the total amount being 4.7, and it's about evenly split between our health analytics office, our office of chief medical officer, and the transformation center. So the critical areas of need are reflected on this first slide. You previously heard from Lori Coyner, who described the work that she leads with data and quality metrics management. And these funds are needed in this area to manage and maintain that data for production of metrics used to evaluate our coordinated care organizations' performance, and to also assess Oregonians' access to health care coverage. The funding is also requested to sustain resources to perform our SIM and waiver required evaluation functions. In the Office of the Chief Medical Officer, this team includes the Health Evidence Review Commission, and funds are needed here to translate the scientific guidelines into patient decision support tools to provide practical tools in this area for patient engagement. Additionally, funding is needed to ensure sufficient oversight of our patient-centered primary care practices, which are a foundation of our health system transformation, and to provide that compliance and technical assistance to ensure the standards are met in those clinics. In the area of the Transformation Center, the center and its activities are a Medicaid waiver requirement, and it has been established to accelerate and spread innovation. And in a post-CCO stand-up phase, really these funds will be targeted on specific performance areas and metrics, such as the integration of behavioral health services, transition of care, alternative payment methods, and population health issues such as obesity and tobacco cessation. You can turn to the next slide. So, you know, in conclusion, sustaining and continuing progress with this limited funding will help ensure that results are continue to be achieved and achieved. So continuing the data management and focus will sustain our ability to measure critical system performance objectives, such as reducing inappropriate use of emergency rooms and ensuring access to affordable health care coverage. Continued quality improvement funding will sustain our progress with ensuring access to high-quality primary care services and use evidence-based decision-making tools for engaging patients in their own care. And then finally, continued technical assistance, focusing on key areas of health system delivery reform, such as behavioral health, alternative payments, and flexible services, will sustain our progress on fulfilling the expectations of the triple aim. So with that, I'm glad to answer questions.
Actually, to be honest, this is more of a comment. It would be easy, I think, for some people to look at these and say, these don't provide direct services to people. This is a lot of money. Why are we doing this? And I would argue this is perhaps one of the most important things that we do in a funny way, because this is the work that helps us ensure that in the long term we maximize our ability to serve people with the and meet the triple aim. And as somebody who's been thinking about healthcare delivery systems for the better part of 30 years now, I would argue very strongly that having this office in place and doing this kind of work is absolutely critical for Oregon as a state and the United States as a whole to move forward with actually reaching the goal that we want, which is to have a healthy population and not break the bank doing it. So I really want to thank your office, Ms. Clement, and strongly encourage this committee to look carefully at the work that they're doing. And I really hope that we can find the money to support these policy option packages, because they're really important in the long term. So I thank you for letting me make a speech more than ask a question, Mr. Chair, but I think it's important for people to understand that.
Thank you.
I would say two things also. One, some of this is required for our waiver. We have no choice.
I'm sorry.
And so that has to be done, as you said. But a word of caution, too. these things can grow into very bureaucratic issues, laying way too much as far as mandates are concerned onto CCOs and other organizations. So let's make it something that's interactive, really helpful, really works well for delivering care, and not just another bureaucratic overlay.
Great.
That you know and I know. Mm-hmm. It can happen.
Yep.
So a word of caution.
That.
On the other hand, it's the right thing to do, and we should be doing it, but it's how it's done as well as doing it. So
thank you.
A word of caution there.
Okay. Thanks. Anybody else?
Any questions?
Wow. I'm not sure what to say.
It's what happens when marijuana precedes the presentation.
has a point.
So I think we're through for today. You guys can go have a cup of coffee or something. And I appreciate you being here this morning. I will say that a couple of your pops I particularly like, and especially the one about Aid and Assist. That is a really good program. I'm looking forward to seeing some help there, that kind of savings. So unless the committee has anything else to speak to, we're going to be adjourned pretty quick. What have we got on the docket for Monday, though?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Monday we have an informational meeting on mobile crisis services, and we'll have guest speakers from Lane County, CAHOOTS program, and the Marion County people.
I'm looking forward to that.
And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.